Chapter 10. You can run, but not hide. If you carry your cell phone with you throughout the day, as most of us do, then you are not invisible. You are being surveilled, even if you don't have geolocation tracking enabled on your phone. For example, if you have iOS 8.2 or earlier, Apple will turn off GPS in airplane mode, but if you have a newer version, as most of us do, GPS remains on, even if you are in airplane mode, unless you take additional steps. To find out how much his mobile carrier knew about his daily activity, a prominent German politician, Malte Spitz, filed suit against the carrier, and a German court ordered the company to turn over its records. The sheer volume of those records was astounding. Just within a 6-month period, they had recorded his location 85,000 times while also tracking every call he had made and received, the phone number of the other party, and how long each call lasted. In other words, this was the metadata produced by Spitz's phone, and it was not just for voice communication, but for text messages as well. Spitz teamed up with other organizations, asking them to format the data and make it public. One organization produced daily summaries. The location of that morning's Green Party meeting was ascertained from the latitude and longitude given in the phone company records. Malte Spitz activity for October 12, 2009. Morning, 4-hour Green Party executive board meeting in the Berlin headquarters located at Platz vor dem Neuen Tor 1. One incoming call, 10 outgoing calls, total time 0 hours 33 minutes 24 seconds. 16 incoming messages, 14 outgoing messages, duration of internet connection, 16 hours, 40 minutes, 54 seconds. From this same data, another organization created an animated map. It shows Spitz's minute-by-minute movements all around Germany and displays a flashing symbol every time he made or received a call. This is an amazing level of detail captured in just a few ordinary days. The data on Spitz isn't a special case, of course, nor is this situation confined to Germany. It's simply a striking example of the data that your cell phone carrier keeps, and it can be used in a court of law. In 2015, a case before the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit involved the use of similar cell phone records in the United States. The case concerned two robbers who robbed a bank, a 7-Eleven, several fast food restaurants, and a jewelry store in Baltimore. By having Sprint hand over information about the location of the prime suspect's phones for the previous 221 days, police were able to tie the suspects to a series of crimes, both by the crimes' proximity to each other and by the suspects' proximity to the crime scenes themselves. A second case, heard by the United States District Court for the Northern District of California, didn't detail specifics of the crime, but it also centered on historical cell site information available from Verizon and AT&T for the target's phones. In the words of the American Civil Liberties Union, which filed an amicus brief in the case, this data generates a near-continuous record of an individual's locations and movements. When a federal judge mentioned cell phone privacy during the California case, the federal prosecutor suggested that cell phone users who are concerned about their privacy could either not carry phones or turn them off, according to the official record. This would seem to violate our Fourth Amendment right to be protected against unreasonable searches. Most people would never equate simply carrying a cell phone with forfeiting their right not to be tracked by the government. But that's what carrying a phone amounts to these days. Both cases note that Verizon, AT&T, and Sprint don't tell customers in privacy policies how pervasive location tracking is. Apparently, AT&T, in a letter to Congress in 2011, said it stores cellular data for 5 years, quote, in case of billing disputes, end quote. And location data is not stored only with the carrier. It's also stored with the vendor. For example, your Google account will retain all your Android geolocation data, and if you use an iPhone, Apple will also have a record of your data. To prevent someone from looking at this data on the device itself and to prevent it from being backed up to the cloud, periodically you should delete location data from your smartphone. On Android devices, go to Google Settings, Location, Delete Location History. On an iOS device, you need to drill down a bit. Apple doesn't make it easy. Go to Settings, Privacy, Location Services, then scroll down to System Services, then scroll down to Frequent Locations, then Clear Recent History. In the case of Google, unless you've turned the feature off, the geolocation data available online can be used to reconstruct your movements. For example, much of your day might be spent at a single location, but there might be a burst of travel as you meet with clients or grab a bite to eat. More disturbing is that if anyone ever gains access to your Google or Apple account, that person can perhaps also pinpoint where you live or who your friends are based on where you spend the majority of your time. At the very least, someone can figure out what your daily routine might be. So it's clear that the simple act of going for a walk today is fraught with opportunities for others to track your behavior. Knowing this, say you consciously leave your cell phone at home. That should solve the problem of being tracked, right? Well, that depends. Do you wear a fitness tracking device, such as Fitbit, Jawbone's Up bracelet, or the Nike Plus Fuel Band? If not, maybe you wear a smartwatch from Apple, Sony, or Samsung. If you wear one or both of these, a fitness band and or a smartwatch, you can still be tracked. These devices and their accompanying apps are designed to record your activity, often with GPS information. So whether it is broadcast live or uploaded later, you can still be tracked. The word surveillance, coined by privacy advocate Steve Mann, is a play off the word surveillance. The French word for above is sur. The French word for below is sous. So surveillance means that instead of being watched from above by other people or by security cameras, for example, we're being watched from below by the small devices that we carry around and maybe even wear on our bodies. Fitness trackers and smartwatches record biometrics such as your heart rate, the number of steps you take, even your body temperature. Apple's App Store supports lots of independently created applications to track health and wellness on its phones and watches. Same with the Google Play Store. And surprise, these apps are set to radio home the data to the company, ostensibly just to collect it for future review by the owner, but also to share it, sometimes without your active consent. For example, during the 2015 Amgen Tour of California, participants in the bicycle race were able to identify who had passed them and later, while online, direct message them. That could get a little creepy when a stranger starts talking to you about a particular move you made during a race, a move you might not even remember making. A similar thing happened to me. On the freeway driving from Los Angeles to Las Vegas, I had been cut off by a guy driving a BMW. Busy on his cell phone, he suddenly switched lanes, swerving within inches of me, scaring the crap out of me. He almost wiped out the both of us. I grabbed my cell phone, called the DMV, and impersonated law enforcement. I got the DMV to run his plate, then they gave me his name, address, and social security number. Then I called AirTouch Cellular, impersonating an AirTouch employee, and had them do a search on his social security number for any cellular accounts. That's how I was able to get his cell number. Hardly more than 5 minutes after the other driver had cut me off, I called the number and got him on the phone. I was still shaking, pissed and angry. I shouted, "Hey, you idiot, I'm the guy you cut off 5 minutes ago when you almost killed us both. I'm from the DMV, and if you pull one more stunt like that, we're going to cancel your driver's license." He must be wondering to this day how some guy on the freeway was able to get his cell phone number. I'd like to think the call scared him into becoming a more considerate driver, but you never know. What goes around comes around, however. At one point, my AT&T mobile account was hacked by some script kiddies, a term for unsophisticated wannabe hackers, using social engineering. The hackers called an AT&T store in the Midwest and posed as an employee at another AT&T store. They persuaded the clerk to reset the email address on my AT&T account so they could reset my online password and gain access to my account details, including all my billing records. In the case of the Amgen Tour of California, riders used the Strava app's flyby feature to share, by default, personal data with other Strava users. In an interview in Forbes, Gareth Nettleton, director of international marketing at Strava, said, "Strava is fundamentally an open platform where athletes connect with a global community. However, the privacy of our athletes is very important to us, and we've taken measures to enable athletes to manage their privacy in simple ways." Strava does offer an enhanced privacy setting that allows you to control who can see your heart rate. You can also create device privacy zones so others can't see where you live or where you work. At the Amgen Tour of California, customers could opt out of the flyby feature so that their activities were marked as private at the time of upload. Other fitness tracking devices and services offer similar privacy protections. You might think that since you don't bike seriously and probably won't cut someone off while running on the footpath around your office complex, you don't need those protections. What could be the harm? But there are other activities you do perform, some in private, that could still be shared over the app and online and therefore create privacy issues. By itself, recording actions such as sleeping or walking up several flights of stairs, especially when done for a specific medical purpose, such as lowering your health insurance premiums, might not compromise your privacy. However, when this data is combined with other data, a holistic picture of you starts to emerge, and it may reveal more information than you're comfortable with. One wearer of a health tracking device discovered upon reviewing his online data that it showed a significant increase in his heart rate whenever he was having sex. In fact, Fitbit, as a company, briefly reported sex as part of its online list of routinely logged activities. Although anonymous, the data was nonetheless searchable by Google until it was publicly disclosed and quickly removed by the company. Some of you might think, so what? True. Not very interesting by itself. But when heart rate data is combined with, say, geolocation data, things could get dicey. Fusion reporter Kashmir Hill took the Fitbit data to its logical extreme, wondering, what if insurance companies combined your activity data with GPS location data to determine not just when you were likely having sex, but where you were having sex? Could a health insurance company identify a customer who was getting lucky in multiple locations per week and give that person a higher medical risk profile based on his or her alleged promiscuity? On the flip side of that, Fitbit data has been successfully used in court cases to prove or disprove previously unverifiable claims. In one extreme case, Fitbit data was used to show that a woman had lied about a rape. To the police, the woman, while visiting Lancaster, Pennsylvania, said she'd awakened around midnight with a stranger on top of her. She further claimed that she'd lost her Fitbit in the struggle for her release. When the police found the Fitbit and the woman gave them her consent to access it, the device told a different story. Apparently, the woman had been awake and walking around all night. According to a local TV station, the woman was charged with false reports to law enforcement, false alarms to public safety, and tampering with evidence for allegedly overturning furniture and placing a knife at the scene to make it appear she had been raped by an intruder. On the other hand, activity trackers can also be used to support disability claims. A Canadian law firm used activity tracker data to show the severe consequences of a client's work injury. The client had provided the data company Viva Metrica, which collects data from wearable devices and compares it to data about the activity and health of the general population, with Fitbit data showing a marked decrease in his activity. Till now, we've always had to rely on clinical interpretation, Simon Muller of McLeod Law LLC in Calgary told Forbes. Now we're looking at longer periods of time through the course of a day, and we have hard data. Even if you don't have a fitness tracker, smartwatches, such as the Galaxy Gear by Samsung, can compromise your privacy in similar ways. If you receive quick-glance notifications, such as texts, emails, and phone calls, on your wrist, others might be able to see those messages too. There's been tremendous growth recently in the use of GoPro, a tiny camera that you strap to your helmet or to the dashboard of your car so that it can record a video of your movements. But what happens if you forget the password to your GoPro mobile app? An Israeli researcher borrowed his friend's GoPro and the mobile app associated with it, but he did not have the password. Like email, the GoPro app allows you to reset the password. However, the procedure, which has since been changed, was flawed. GoPro sent a link to your email as part of the password reset process, but this link actually led to a zip file that was to be downloaded and inserted onto the device's SD card. When the researcher opened the zip file, he found a text file named Settings that contained the user's wireless credentials, including the SSID and password the GoPro would use to access the internet. The researcher discovered that if he changed the number in the link, 860-5145, to another number, say 860-4144, he could access other people's GoPro configuration data, which included their wireless passwords. You could argue that Eastman Kodak jump-started the discussion of privacy in America, or at least made it interesting, in the late 1800s. Until that point, photography was a serious, time-consuming, inconvenient art requiring specialized equipment, cameras, lights, darkrooms, and long stretches of immobility while subjects posed in a studio. Then, Kodak came along and introduced a portable, relatively affordable camera. The first of its line sold for $25, around $100 today. Kodak subsequently introduced the Brownie camera, which sold for a mere $1. Both these cameras were designed to be taken outside the home and office. They were the mobile computers and mobile phones of their day. Suddenly, people had to deal with the fact that someone on the beach or in a public park might have a camera, and that person might actually include you within the frame of a photo. You had to look nice. You had to act responsibly. It was not only changing your attitude toward photography, but toward the thing itself that you were photographing, says Brian Wallace, former chief curator at the International Center of Photography. So you had to stage a dinner and stage a birthday party. I believe we actually do behave differently when we are being watched. Most of us are on our best behavior when we know there's a camera on us, though, of course, there will always be those who couldn't care less. The advent of photography also influenced how people felt about their privacy. All of a sudden, there could be a visual record of someone behaving badly. Indeed, today we have dash cams and body cameras on our law enforcement officers, so there will be a record of our behavior when we're confronted with the law. And today, with facial recognition technology, you can take a picture of someone and have it matched to his or her Facebook profile. Today we have selfies. But in 1888, that kind of constant exposure was still a shocking and disconcerting novelty. The Hartford Courant sounded an alarm. The sedate citizen can't indulge in any hilariousness without incurring the risk of being caught in the act and having his photograph passed around among his Sunday school children. And the young fellow who wishes to spoon with his best girl while sailing down the river must keep himself constantly sheltered by his umbrella. Some people didn't like the change. In the 1880s, in the United States, a group of women smashed a camera on board a train because they didn't want its owner to take their picture. In the UK, a group of British boys ganged together to roam the beaches, threatening anyone who tried to take pictures of women coming out of the ocean after a swim. Writing in the 1890s, Samuel Warren and Louis Brandeis, the latter of whom subsequently served on the Supreme Court, wrote in an article that instantaneous photographs and newspaper enterprise have invaded the sacred precincts of private and domestic life. They proposed that U.S. law should formally recognize privacy, and in part to stem the tide of surreptitious photography, impose liability for any intrusions. Such laws were passed in several states. Today, several generations have grown up with the threat of instantaneous photographs. Polaroid, anyone? But now we have to also contend with the ubiquity of photography. Everywhere you go, you are bound to be captured on video, whether or not you give your permission. And those images might be accessible to anyone, anywhere in the world. We live with a contradiction when it comes to privacy. On the one hand, we value it intensely, regard it as a right, and see it as bound up in our freedom and independence. Shouldn't anything we do on our own property behind closed doors remain private? On the other hand, humans are curious creatures, and we now have the means to fulfill that curiosity in previously unimaginable ways. Ever wonder what's over that fence across the street in your neighbor's backyard? Technology may be able to answer that question for almost anyone. Drone companies such as 3D Robotics and Sci-Fi make it easy today for the average Joe to own his own drone. For example, I have the DJI Phantom 4 drone. Drones are remote-controlled aircraft and significantly more sophisticated than the kind you used to be able to buy at Radio Shack. Almost all come with tiny video cameras. They give you the chance to see the world in a new way. Some drones can also be controlled from your cell phone. Personal drones are peeping Toms on steroids. Almost nothing is out of bounds now that you can hover a few hundred feet above the ground. Currently, the insurance industry uses drones for business reasons. Think about that. If you are an insurance adjuster and need to get a sense of the condition of a property you are about to insure, you can fly a drone around it, both to visually inspect areas you didn't have access to before and to create a permanent record of what you find. You can fly high and look down to get the type of view that previously you could only have gotten from a helicopter. The personal drone is now an option for spying on our neighbors. We can just fly high over someone's roof and look down. Perhaps the neighbor has a pool. Perhaps the neighbor likes to bathe in the nude. Things have gotten complicated. We have the expectation of privacy within our own homes and on our own property, but now that's being challenged. Google, for example, masks out faces and license plates and other personal information on Google Street View and Google Earth. But a neighbor with a private drone gives you none of those assurances, though you can try asking him nicely not to fly over your backyard. A video-equipped drone gives you Google Earth and Google Street View combined. There are some regulations. The Federal Aviation Administration, for instance, has guidelines stating that a drone cannot leave the operator's line of sight, that it cannot fly within a certain distance of airports, and that it cannot fly at heights exceeding certain levels. There's an app called Before You Fly that will help you determine where to fly your drone. And in response to commercial drone use, several states have passed laws restricting or severely limiting their use. In Texas, ordinary citizens can't fly drones, although there are exceptions, including one for real estate agents. The most liberal attitude toward drones is perhaps found in Colorado, where civilians can legally shoot drones out of the sky. At a minimum, the U.S. government should require drone enthusiasts to register their toys. In Los Angeles, where I live, someone crashed a drone into power lines in West Hollywood near the intersection of Larrabee Street and Sunset Boulevard. Had the drone been registered, authorities might know who inconvenienced 700 people for hours on end while dozens of power company employees worked into the night to restore power to the area. Retail stores increasingly want to get to know their customers. One method that actually works is a kind of cell phone IMSI catcher. When you walk into a store, the IMSI catcher grabs information from your cell phone and somehow figures out your number. From there, the system is able to query tons of databases and build a profile on you. Brick-and-mortar retailers are also using facial recognition technology. Think of it as a super-size Walmart greeter. "Hello, Kevin," could be the standard greeting I get from a clerk in the not-too-distant future, even though I might never have been in that store before. The personalization of your retail experience is another, albeit very subtle, form of surveillance. We can no longer shop anonymously. In June of 2015, barely 2 weeks after leaning on Congress to pass the USA Freedom Act, a modified version of the Patriot Act with some privacy protection added, 9 consumer privacy groups, some of which had lobbied heavily in favor of the Freedom Act, grew frustrated with several large retailers and walked out of negotiations to restrict the use of facial recognition. At issue was whether consumers should, by default, have to give permission before they can be scanned. That sounds reasonable, yet not one of the major retail organizations involved in the negotiations would cede this point. According to them, if you walk into their stores, you should be fair game for scanning and identification. Some people may want that kind of personal attention when they walk into a store, but many of us will find it just plain unsettling. The stores see it another way. They don't want to give consumers the right to opt out because they're trying to catch known shoplifters who would simply opt out if that were an option. If automatic facial recognition is used, known shoplifters would be identified the moment they enter a store. What do the customers say? At least in the United Kingdom, 7 out of 10 survey respondents find the use of facial recognition technology within a store too creepy. And some U.S. states, including Illinois, have taken it upon themselves to regulate the collection and storage of biometric data. These regulations have led to lawsuits. For example, a Chicago man is suing Facebook because he did not give the online service express permission to use facial recognition technology to identify him in other people's photos. Facial recognition can be used to identify a person based solely on his or her image. But what if you already know who the person is and you just want to make sure he's where he should be? This is another potential use of facial recognition. Moshe Greenspan is the CEO of the Israel and Las Vegas-based facial recognition company Face 6. Their software, Churchix, is used for, among other things, taking attendance at churches. The idea is to help churches identify the congregants who attend irregularly so as to encourage them to come more often, and to identify the congregants who do regularly attend so as to encourage them to donate more money to the church. Face 6 says there are at least 30 churches around the world using its technology. All the church needs to do is upload high-quality photos of its congregants. The system will then be on the lookout for them at services and social functions. When asked if the churches tell their congregants they are being tracked, Greenspan told Fusion, "I don't think churches tell people. We encourage them to do so, but I don't think they do." Jonathan Zittrain, director of Harvard Law School's Berkman Center for Internet and Society, has facetiously suggested that humans need a no-follow tag like the ones used on certain websites. This would keep people who want to opt out from showing up in facial recognition databases. Toward that end, the National Institute of Informatics in Japan has created a commercial privacy visor. The eyeglasses, which sell for around $240, produce light visible only to cameras. The photosensitive light is emitted around the eyes to thwart facial recognition systems. According to early testers, the glasses are successful 90% of the time. The only caveat appears to be that they are not suitable for driving or cycling. They may not be all that fashionable either, but they're perfect for exercising your right to privacy in a public place. Knowing that your privacy can be compromised when you're out in the open, you might feel safer in the privacy of your car, your home, or even your office. Unfortunately, that is no longer the case. In the next few chapters, I'll explain why. Chapter 11. Hey, Kit, don't share my location. Researchers Charlie Miller and Chris Valasek were no strangers to hacking cars. Previously, the two had hacked a Toyota Prius, but they had done so while physically connected to the car and sitting in the back seat. Then, in the summer of 2015, Miller and Valasek succeeded in taking over the main controls of a Jeep Cherokee while it was traveling at 70 miles per hour down a freeway in St. Louis. They could remotely control a car without being anywhere near it. The Jeep in question did have a driver, Wired reporter Andy Greenberg. The researchers had told Greenberg beforehand, no matter what happens, don't panic. That turned out to be a tall order, even for a guy who was expecting to have his car hacked. "Immediately my accelerator stopped working," Greenberg wrote of the experience. "As I frantically pressed the pedal and watched the RPMs climb, the Jeep lost half its speed, then slowed to a crawl. This occurred just as I reached a long overpass with no shoulder to offer an escape. The experiment had ceased to be fun." Afterward, the researchers faced some criticism for being reckless and dangerous. Greenberg's Jeep was on a public road, not on a test track, so Missouri law enforcement is, at the time of this writing, still considering pressing charges against Miller and Valasek and possibly Greenberg. Hacking connected cars remotely has been talked about for years, but it took Miller and Valasek's experiment to get the automobile industry to pay attention. Whether it was stunt hacking or legitimate research, it got car manufacturers to start thinking seriously about cyber safety and about whether Congress should prohibit the hacking of automobiles. Other researchers have shown they can reverse engineer the protocol controlling your vehicle by intercepting and analyzing the GSM or CDMA traffic from your car's onboard computer to the automaker's systems. The researchers were able to spoof the automotive control systems by sending SMS messages to lock and unlock car doors. Some have even hijacked remote start capabilities using the same methods as well. But Miller and Valisek were the first to be able to take complete control of a car remotely, and they claim that, by using the same methods, they could take over cars in other states as well. Perhaps the most important result of the Miller-Valisek experiment was a recall by Chrysler of more than 1.4 million of its cars because of a programming issue, the first recall of its kind. As an interim measure, Chrysler also suspended the affected car's connection to the Sprint network, which the cars had used for telematics, the data that cars collect and share with the manufacturer in real time. Miller and Valisek told an audience at DEF CON 23 that they had realized they could do that, take over cars in other states, but they knew it wasn't ethical. Instead, they conducted their controlled experiment with Greenberg in Miller's hometown. In this chapter, I'll discuss the various ways the cars we drive, the trains we ride, and the mobile apps we use to power our daily commute to work are vulnerable to cyber attacks, not to mention the numerous privacy compromises that our connected cars introduce into our lives. When Johanna Bouyan, a reporter for BuzzFeed, arrived at the New York offices of Uber, the car calling service, in one of Uber's own cars, Josh Maurer, the general manager, was waiting. "There you are," he said, holding up his iPhone. "I was tracking you." It was not an auspicious start to their interview, which touched upon, among other things, consumer privacy. Until Bouyan's story appeared in November of 2014, few outside of Uber were even aware of GodView, a tool with which Uber tracks the location of its thousands of contract drivers as well as their customers, all in real time. As I mentioned earlier, apps routinely ask users for various permissions, including the right to access their geolocation data. The Uber app goes even further. It asks for your approximate Wi-Fi and precise GPS location, the right to access your contacts, and does not allow your mobile device to sleep, so it can keep tabs on where you are. Bouyan allegedly told Maurer up front that she did not give the company permission to track her anytime and anywhere. But she did, although maybe not explicitly. The permission was in the user agreement she consented to upon downloading the service to her mobile device. After their meeting, Maurer emailed Bouyan logs of some of her recent Uber trips. Uber compiles a personal dossier for every customer, recording every single trip he or she makes. That's a bad idea if the database isn't secure. Known in the security business as a honeypot, the Uber database can attract all sorts of snoops, from the U.S. government to Chinese hackers. In 2015, Uber changed some of its privacy policies, in some instances to the detriment of the consumer. Uber now collects geolocation data from all U.S.-based users, even if the app runs only in the background, and even if satellite and cellular communications are turned off. Uber said it will use Wi-Fi and IP addresses to track the users offline. That means the Uber app acts as a silent spy on your mobile device. The company did not, however, say why it needs this ability. Nor has Uber fully explained why it needs GodView. On the other hand, according to the company's privacy policy, Uber has a strict policy prohibiting all employees at every level from accessing a rider or driver's data. The only exception to this policy is for a limited set of legitimate business purposes. Legitimate business might include monitoring accounts suspected of fraud and resolving driver issues, for example, missed connections. It probably doesn't include tracking a reporter's travels. You might think Uber would give its customers the right to delete tracking information. No. And if after reading this you've deleted the app from your phone, well, guess what? The data still exists within Uber. Under the revised privacy policy, Uber also collects your address book information. If you have an iPhone, you can go into your settings and change your preference for contact sharing. If you own an Android, that's not an option. Uber representatives have claimed that the company is not currently collecting this kind of customer data. By including data collection in the privacy policy, however, which existing users have already agreed to and which new users must agree to, the company ensures that it can roll out these features at any time and the user won't have any redress. Uber's God view is perhaps enough to make you nostalgic for regular old taxi cabs. In the past, you would jump into a taxi, state your destination, and pay cash for the ride once you arrived. In other words, your trip would be almost completely anonymous. With the advent of nearly universal acceptance of credit cards in the early 21st century, a lot of ordinary transactions have become traceable. And so there probably is a record of your taxi ride, somewhere. Maybe it doesn't reside with a specific driver or company, but it certainly resides with your credit card company. Back in the 1990s, I used to work as a private investigator, and I could figure out my target's movements by obtaining their credit card transactions. One need only look at a statement to know that last week you rode a taxi in New York City and paid $54 for that trip. Around 2010, taxis began to use GPS data. Now the taxi company knows your pickup and drop-off location, the amount of your fare, and perhaps the credit card number associated with your trip. This data is kept private by New York, San Francisco, and other cities that support the open data movement in government, providing researchers with rich and anonymized data sets. As long as names are not included, what harm could there be in making such anonymized data public? In 2013, Anthony Tokar, then a Northwestern University graduate student interning for a company called Neustar, looked at the anonymized metadata publicly released by the New York City Taxi and Limousine Commission. This data set contained a record of every trip taken by the cars in its fleet during the previous year and included the cab number, the pickup and drop-off times, the locations, the fare and tip amounts, and anonymized, hashed, versions of the taxi's license and medallion numbers. By itself, this data set isn't very interesting. The hash value in this case is, unfortunately, relatively easy to undo. When you combine the public data set with other data sets, however, you start to get a complete picture of what's going on. In this case, Tokar was able to determine where specific celebrities, such as Bradley Cooper and Jessica Alba, had taken their taxis within New York City during the previous year. How did he make this leap? He already had geolocation data, so he knew where and when the taxis picked up and dropped off their fares, but he had to go further to determine who was inside the cab. So, he combined the New York City Taxi and Limousine Commission metadata with online photos from ordinary tabloid websites available online, a paparazzi database. Think about that. Paparazzi frequently photograph celebrities just as they enter and exit New York City's taxis. In these cases, the cab's unique medallion number is often visible within the image. It's printed on the side of every cab, so a cab number photographed alongside Bradley Cooper, for instance, could be matched to the publicly available data regarding pickup and drop-off locations and fare and tip amounts. Fortunately, not all of us have paparazzi on our trail. That doesn't mean there aren't other ways to trace our travels, though. Maybe you don't take taxis. Are there other ways to determine your location? There are, even if you take public transportation. If you ride a bus, train, or ferry to work, you're no longer invisible among the masses. Transit systems are experimenting with using mobile apps and near-field communication, NFC, to tag riders as they get on and get off public transportation. NFC is a short-distance radio signal that often requires physical contact. Payment systems such as Apple Pay, Android Pay, and Samsung Pay all use NFC to make fumbling for quarters a thing of the past. Let's say you have an NFC-enabled phone with an app from your local transit authority installed. The app will want a connection to your bank account or credit card so that you can always board any bus or train or ferry without worrying about a negative balance on your account. That connection to your credit card number, if it is not obscured by a token or placeholder number, could reveal to the transit authority who you are. Replacing your credit card number with a token is a new option that Apple, Android, and Samsung offer. That way the merchant, in this case the transit authority, only has a token and not your real credit card number. Using a token will cut down on data breaches affecting credit cards in the near future because the criminal would then need two databases, the token and the real credit card number behind the token. But say you don't use an NFC-enabled phone. Instead, you have a transit card, like the Charlie card in Boston, the Smart Trip card in Washington, D.C., and the Clipper card in San Francisco. These cards use tokens to alert the receiving device, whether a turnstile or a fare collection box, that there is enough of a balance for you to ride the bus, train, or ferry. However, transit systems don't use tokens on the back end. The card itself has only an account number, not your credit card information, on its magnetic strip. But if the transit authority were to be breached on the back end, then your credit card or bank information could also be exposed. Also, some transit systems want you to register for their cards online so that they can send you email, meaning your email addresses could also be exposed in a future hack. Either way, the ability to anonymously ride a bus has largely gone out the window unless you pay for the card using cash, not credit. This development is enormously helpful for law enforcement. Because these commuter card companies are privately owned third parties, not governments, they can set whatever rules they want about sharing data. They can share it not only with law enforcement, but also with lawyers pursuing civil cases, in case your ex wants to harass you. So someone looking at the transit authority logs might know exactly who went through a subway station at such and such a time, but that person might not know which train his target boarded, especially if the station is a hub for several lines. What if your mobile device could resolve the question of which train you then rode and therefore infer your destination? Researchers at Nanjing University in China decided to answer that question by focusing their work on something inside our phones called an accelerometer. Every mobile device has one. It's a tiny chip responsible for determining the orientation of your device, whether you are holding it in landscape or portrait view. These chips are so sensitive that the researchers decided to use accelerometer data alone in their calculations, and sure enough, they were able to accurately predict which subway train a user is riding. This is because most subway lines include turns that affect the accelerometer. Also important is the length of time between station stops. You need only to look at a map to see why. The accuracy of their predictions improved with each station a rider passed. The researchers claim their method has a 92% accuracy rate. Let's say you own an old model car and drive yourself to work. You might think you're invisible, just one of a million cars on the road today. And you might be right. But new technology, even if it is not part of the car itself, is eroding your anonymity. Chances are, with effort, someone could still identify you whizzing by on the freeway pretty quickly. In the city of San Francisco, the Municipal Transportation Agency has started to use the Fast Track toll system, which allows you to cross any of the 8 Bay Area bridges with ease, to track the movements of Fast Track-enabled cars throughout the city. Using technology similar to what toll bridges use to read the Fast Track or Easy Pass device in your car, the city has started searching for those devices as users circle around looking for parking. But officials are not always interested in your movements. Rather, they're interested in the parking space, most of which are equipped with electronic parking meters. Spaces that are highly sought after can charge a higher rate. The city can wirelessly adjust the price at specific meters, including meters near a popular event. In addition, in 2014, officials decided not to use human toll takers at the Golden Gate Bridge, so everyone, even tourists, is required to pay electronically or receive a bill in the mail. How do the authorities know where to send your bill? They photograph your license plate when you cross the toll plaza. These license plate photographs are also used to nab red light runners at problematic intersections. And interestingly, police are using a similar strategy as they drive by parking lots and residential driveways. Police departments passively track your car's movements every day with automated license plate recognition, ALPR, technology. They can photograph your car's license plate and store that data, sometimes for years, depending on the police department's policy. ALPR cameras scan and read every plate they pass, whether the car is registered to a criminal or not. Ostensibly, ALPR technology is used primarily to locate stolen cars, wanted criminals, and assist with amber alerts. The technology involves three cameras mounted to the top of a patrol car that are hooked up to a computer screen inside the vehicle. The system is further linked to a Department of Justice database that keeps track of the license plates of stolen cars and vehicles associated with crimes. As an officer drives, the ALPR technology can scan up to 60 plates per second. If a scanned plate matches a plate in the DOJ database, the officer receives an alert both visually and audibly. The Wall Street Journal first reported on license plate recognition technology in 2012. At issue for those who oppose or question ALPR technology is not the system itself, but rather how long the data is kept and why some law enforcement agencies will not release it, even to the owner of the car being tracked. It's a disturbing tool that the police can use to figure out where you've been. Automatic license plate readers are a sophisticated way of tracking drivers' locations, and when their data is aggregated over time, they can paint detailed pictures of people's lives, notes Bennett Stein of the ACLU's Project on Speech, Privacy, and Technology. One California man who filed a public records request was disturbed by the number of photos, more than 100, that had been taken of his license plate. Most were at bridge crossings and other very public locations. One, however, showed him and his daughters exiting their family car while it was parked in their own driveway. Mind you, this person wasn't under suspicion for committing a crime. Documents obtained by the ACLU show that even the Office of the FBI's General Counsel has questioned the use of ALPR in the absence of a coherent government policy. Unfortunately, you don't have to file a public records request to see some of the ALPR data. According to the EFF, the images from more than 100 ALPR cameras are available to anyone online. All you need is a browser. Before it went public with its findings, the EFF worked with law enforcement to correct the leakage of data. The EFF said this misconfiguration was found in more than just those 100 instances and urged law enforcement around the country to take down or limit what's posted on the internet. But as of this writing, it is still possible, if you type the right query into a search window, to gain access to license plate images in many communities. One researcher found more than 64,000 plate images and their corresponding locational data points during a one-week period. Perhaps you don't own a car and only rent one occasionally. Still, you are definitely not invisible given all the personal and credit card information you must supply at the time of rental. What's more, most rental cars today have GPS built in. I know. I found out the hard way. When you are given a loaner car from a dealership because your car is being serviced, you typically agree not to take it across state lines. The dealership wants to keep the car in the state where it was borrowed. This rule mostly concerns their insurance, not yours. This happened to me. I brought my car into a Lexus dealer in Las Vegas for servicing, and they let me use a loaner car. Since it was past closing time at the dealership, I just signed the paperwork without reading it, mostly because I was being rushed by the service associate. Later, I drove the car to Northern California, to the Bay Area, for a consulting gig. When the service guy called me to discuss his recommendations, he asked, "Where are you?" I said, "San Ramon, California." He said, "Yeah, that's where we see the car." He then read me the riot act about taking the car out of state. Apparently, the loaner agreement I had quickly signed stipulated that I was not to take the car out of Nevada. When you rent or borrow a car today, there's a temptation to pair your wireless device to the entertainment system to recreate the audio experience you have at home. Of course, there are some immediate privacy concerns. This isn't your car. So what happens to your infotainment data once you return the car to the rental agency? Before you pair your device with a car that isn't yours, take a look at the entertainment system. Perhaps by tapping the mobile phone setting, you will see previous users' devices and/or names listed on the Bluetooth screen. think about whether you want to join that list. In other words, your data doesn't just disappear when you leave the car. You have to remove it yourself. You might be thinking, what harm is there in sharing my favorite tunes with others? The problem is that your music isn't the only thing that gets shared. When most mobile devices connect to an automobile infotainment system, they automatically link your contacts to the car's system. The assumption is that you might want to make a hands-free call while driving, so having your contacts stored in the car makes it that much easier. Trouble is, it's not your car. When I get a rental car, says David Miller, chief security officer for Covisint, the last thing I do is pair my phone. It downloads all my contacts because that's what it wants to do. In most rental cars, you can go in and, if somebody's paired with it, see their contacts. The same is true when you finally sell your car. Modern cars give you access to your digital world while on the road. Want to check Twitter? Want to post to Facebook? Cars today bear an increasing resemblance to your traditional PC and your cell phone. They contain personal data that you should remove before the machine or device is sold. Working in the security business will get you in the habit of thinking ahead, even about mundane transactions. I spend all this time connecting my vehicle to my whole life, says Miller, and then in 5 years I sell it. How do I disconnect it from my whole life? I don't want the guy who buys my car to be able to see my Facebook friends, so you have to deprovision. Security guys are much more interested in the security vulnerabilities around deprovisioning than provisioning. And just as you do with your mobile device, you will need to password protect your car. Except, at the time of this writing, there is no mechanism available that will allow you to password lock your infotainment system. Nor is it easy to delete all the accounts you've put into your car over the years. How you do it varies by manufacturer, make, and model. Perhaps that will change. Someone could invent a one-stop button that removes an entire user profile from your car. Until then, at least go online and change all your social media passwords after you sell your car. Perhaps the best example of a computer on wheels is a Tesla, a state-of-the-art all-electronic vehicle. In June of 2015, Tesla reached a significant milestone. Collectively, Tesla cars worldwide had been driven more than 1 billion miles. I drive a Tesla. They're great cars. But given their sophisticated dashboards and constant cellular communication, they raise questions about the data they collect. When you take possession of a Tesla, you are offered a consent form. You have the ability to control whether Tesla will record any information about your car over a wireless communication system. You can enable or disable sharing your personal data with Tesla via a touch screen on the dashboard. Many people accept the argument that their data will help Tesla make a better car in the future. According to Tesla's privacy policy, the company may collect the vehicle identification number, speed information, odometer readings, battery usage information, battery charging history, information about electrical system functions, software version information, infotainment system data, and safety-related data, including information regarding the vehicle's SRS systems, brakes, security, and e-brake system, among other things, to assist in analyzing the performance of the vehicle. Tesla states that they may collect such information in person, e.g. during a service appointment, or via remote access. That's what they say in their printed policy. In practice, they can also determine your car's location and status at any time. To the media, Tesla has been cagey about what data it collects in real time and how it uses that data. Like Uber, Tesla sits in a godlike position that allows it to know everything about each car and its location at any moment. If that unnerves you, you can contact Tesla and opt out of its telematics program. However, if you do, you will miss out on automatic software updates, which include security fixes and new features. Of course, the security community is interested in the Tesla, and independent security researcher Nitesh Dunjani has identified some problems. While he agrees with me that the Tesla Model S is a great car and a fantastic product of innovation, Dunjani found that Tesla uses a rather weak one-factor authentication system to access the car's systems remotely. The Tesla website and app lack the ability to limit the number of login attempts on a user account, which means an attacker could potentially use brute force to crack a user's password. That means a third party could, assuming your password is cracked, log in and use the Tesla API to check the location of your vehicle. That person could also log in remotely to the Tesla app and control the vehicle's systems, its air conditioner, lights, and so on, although the vehicle must be stationary. Most of Dunjani's concerns have been addressed by Tesla at the time of this writing, but the situation is an example of how much more auto manufacturers need to do today to secure their cars. Just offering an app to remotely start and check the status of your car isn't good enough. It also has to be secure. The most recent update, a feature called Summon, allows you to tell the car to pull itself out of the garage or park itself in a tight spot. In the future, Summon will allow the car to pick you up from any location across the country. Kind of like the old TV show, Knight Rider. In refuting a negative review in the New York Times, Tesla admitted to the power of data they have on their side. Times reporter John Broder said that his Tesla Model S had broken down and left him stranded. In a blog, Tesla countered, identifying several data points they said called into question Broder's version of the story. For example, Tesla noted that Broder drove at speeds ranging from 65 miles per hour to 81 miles per hour, with an average cabin temperature setting of 72 degrees Fahrenheit. According to Forbes, data recorders in the Model S knew the temperature settings in the car, the battery level throughout the trip, the car's speed from minute to minute, and the exact route taken, down to the fact that the car reviewer drove circles in a parking lot when the car's battery was almost dead. Telematics capability is a logical extension of the black boxes mandatory in all cars produced for sale in the United States after 2015. But black boxes in cars aren't new at all. They date back to the 1970s, when airbags were first introduced. In collisions, people back then sustained life-threatening injuries from airbags, and some died from the force of the bags hitting their bodies. In some cases, had the car not been equipped with those bags, the occupants might be alive today. In order to make improvements, engineers needed the data on the deployment of the bags in the moments before and after a crash, collected by the airbag's sensing and diagnostic modules, SDMs. However, the vehicle owners were not told until very recently that the sensors in their cars recorded data about their driving. Triggered by sudden changes in G-forces, black boxes in cars, like black boxes in airplanes, record only the last few seconds or so surrounding a G-force event, such as sudden acceleration, torque, and hard braking. But it is easy to envision more kinds of data being collected in these black boxes and transmitted in real time via cellular connections. Imagine, in the future, that data collected over a 3 to 5 day period could be stored either on the vehicle or in the cloud. Instead of trying to describe that ping-ping noise you hear when your car travels 35 miles per hour or more, you'd just give your mechanic access to the recorded data. The real question is, who else has access to all this data? Even Tesla admits that the data it collects might be used by third parties. What if the third party was your bank? If it had an agreement with your car's manufacturer, it could track your driving ability and judge your eligibility for future auto loans accordingly. Or your health insurer could do the same, or even your car insurer. It might be necessary for the federal government to weigh in on who owns data from your car and what rights you have to keep such data private. There is little you can do about this today, but it's worth paying attention to in the future. Even if you don't own a Tesla, your auto manufacturer might offer an app that allows you to open the car doors, start the engine, or even inspect certain diagnostics on your car. One researcher has shown that these signals, between the car, the cloud, and the app, can be hacked and used to track a target vehicle, effortlessly unlock it, trigger the horn and alarm, and even control its engine. The hacker can do just about everything except put the car in gear and drive it away. That still requires the driver's key, although I recently figured how to disable the Tesla key fob so that the Tesla is completely grounded. By using a small transmitter at 315 megahertz, you can make it so the key fob cannot be detected, thus disabling the car. Speaking at DEF CON 23, Sami Kamkar, the security researcher best known for developing the MySpace-specific Sami worm back in 2005, demonstrated a device he built called OwnStar, which can impersonate a known vehicle network. With it, he could open your OnStar-enabled General Motors vehicle, for example. The trick involves physically placing the device on the bumper or underside of a target car or truck. The device spoofs the automobile's wireless access point, which automatically associates the unsuspecting driver's mobile device with the new access point, assuming the driver is previously associated with the original access point. Whenever the user launches the OnStar mobile app on either iOS or Android, the OwnStar code exploits a flaw in the app to steal the driver's OnStar credentials. "As soon as you're on my network and you open the app, I've taken over," Kamkar said. After obtaining the user's login credentials for Remote Link, the software that powers OnStar, and listening for the locking or unlocking sound, beep beep, an attacker can track down a car in a crowded parking lot, open it, and steal anything valuable inside. The attacker would then remove the device from the bumper. It's a very neat attack since there's no sign of a forced intrusion. The owner and the insurance company are left to puzzle out what happened. Researchers have found that connected car standards designed to improve traffic flow can also be tracked. The vehicle-to-vehicle, V2V, and vehicle-to-infrastructure, V2I, communications, together known as V2X, call for cars to broadcast messages 10 times a second using a portion of the Wi-Fi spectrum at 5.9 GHz, known as 802.11p. Unfortunately, this data is sent unencrypted. It has to be. When cars are speeding down a highway, the millisecond of delay needed to decrypt the signal could result in a dangerous crash. So the designers have opted for open, unencrypted communications. Knowing this, they insist that the communications contain no personal information, not even a license plate number. However, to prevent forgeries, the messages are digitally signed. It's these digital signatures, like the IMEI, mobile phone serial number, data sent from our cell phones, that can be traced back to the registered owners of the vehicle. Jonathan Pettit, one of the researchers behind the study, told Wired, "The vehicle is saying, 'I'm Alice, this is my location, this is my speed and my direction.' Everyone around you can listen to that. They can say, 'There's Alice. She claimed she was at home, but she drove by the drugstore, went to a fertility clinic,' this kind of thing. Someone can infer a lot of private information about the passenger." Pettit has designed a system for around $1,000 that can listen for the V2X communications, and he suggests that a small town could be covered with his sensors for about $1 million. Rather than having a large police force, the town would use the sensors to identify drivers and, more important, their habits. One proposal from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and European authorities is to have the 802.11p signal, the vehicle's pseudonym, change every 5 minutes. That won't, however, stop a dedicated attacker. He will just install more roadside sensors that will identify the vehicle before and after it makes the change. In short, there appear to be very few options to avoid vehicle identification. "Pseudonym changing doesn't stop tracking. It can only mitigate this attack," says Pettit. "But it's still needed to improve privacy. We want to demonstrate that in any deployment, you still have to have this protection or someone will be able to track you." Car connectivity to the internet is actually good for vehicle owners. Manufacturers are able to push out software bug fixes instantly should they be required. At the time of this writing, Volkswagen, Land Rover, and Chrysler have experienced high-profile software vulnerabilities. However, only a few automakers, such as Mercedes, Tesla, and Ford, send over-the-air updates to all their cars. The rest of us still have to go into the shop to get our automobile software updated. If you think the way Tesla and Uber are tracking every ride you take is scary, then self-driving cars will be even scarier. Like the personal surveillance devices we keep in our pockets, our cell phones, self-driving cars will need to keep track of where we want to go and perhaps even know where we are at a given moment in order to be always at the ready. The scenario proposed by Google and others is that cities will no longer need parking lots or garages. Your car will drive around until it is needed. Or perhaps cities will follow the on-demand model, in which private ownership is a thing of the past and everyone shares whatever car is nearby. Just as our cell phones are less like copper wire phones than they are like traditional PCs, self-driving cars will also be a new form of computer. They'll be self-contained computing devices, able to make split-second autonomous decisions while driving in case they are cut off from their network communications. Using cellular connections, they will be able to access a variety of cloud services, allowing them to receive real-time traffic information, road construction updates, and weather reports from the National Weather Service. These updates are available on some conventional vehicles right now, but it's predicted that by 2025, a majority of the cars on the road will be connected to other cars, to roadside assistance services, and it's likely that a sizable percentage of these will be self-driving. Imagine what a software bug in a self-driving car would look like. Meanwhile, every trip you take will be recorded somewhere. You will need an app, much like the Uber app, that will be registered to you and to your mobile device. That app will record your travels and presumably the expenses associated with your trip if they would be charged to the credit card on file, which could be subpoenaed. If not from Uber, then from your credit card company. And given that a private company will most likely have a hand in designing the software that runs these self-driving cars, you would be at the mercy of those companies and their decisions about whether to share any or all of your personal information with law enforcement agencies. Welcome to the future. I hope that by the time you read this, there will be tougher regulations, or at least the hint of tougher regulations in the near future regarding the manufacture of connected cars and their communications protocols. Rather than use widely accepted software and hardware security practices that are standard today, the auto industry, like the medical device industry and others, is attempting to reinvent the wheel, as though we haven't learned much about network security over the last 40 years. We have. And it would be best if these industries started following existing best practices instead of insisting that what they are doing is radically different from what's been done before. It's not. Unfortunately, failure to secure code in a car has much greater consequences than a mere software crash with its blue screen of death. In a car, that failure could harm or kill a human being. At the time of this writing, at least one person has died while a Tesla was in beta autopilot mode. Whether the result of faulty brakes or an error in judgment by the car's software remains to be resolved. Reading this, you may not want to leave your home. In the next chapter, I'll discuss ways in which the gadgets in our homes are listening and recording what we do behind closed doors. In this case, it's not the government that we need to be afraid of.